Hey everybody, this is Jim Zub from Skull Kickers, and this is the Fanboy Factor.
Welcome everyone, this is the Fanboy Factor. I'm Brian Isaacs. With me as always is my co-host JQ and Mike Sanchez.
Hello.
Hello, hello.
And our lovely producer running everything behind the scenes, Mike Hopkins.
No.
God. Our guest tonight is self-published writer-artist who has created Strangers in Paradise, Echo, and Rachel Rising. He has won many awards for his work, including coveted Will Eisner and Harvey Awards and two GLAAD Awards. Everyone, please welcome Terry Moore. Welcome, Terry.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
So glad to have you on. I got to tell you, personally, I'm a huge fan of your Strangers in Paradise run. Still to this day, I think it has to be one of the most amazing things I've ever read.
Wow.
It's, you know, I like the nonlinear writing style you had with it, and I found it very intriguing. Now, I got to ask, I think the first question is, I mean, you pretty much started off as, you know, doing this all on your own. I mean, how come you decided to do it, you know, go off, do it indie first instead of trying with, like, one of the big two or something?
Yeah, well, you know, the truth is I actually did submit it to the big two and the smaller six and then the even smaller nine.
Jeez.
Nobody wanted it. It just was kind of, especially what I was showing them in that first year, it was I showed them a first draft that I ended up redrawing. But everybody turned it down. But at the same time, I discovered the self-publishing movement, and those guys looked like they were having fun. It was kind of like a little rock and roll movement. that appealed to me and just timed out. As it was, though, a smaller publisher did pick it up and did a miniseries, and that kind of got me going, and then I started self-publishing.
Wow. It's one of my favorite series.
Thanks. I really appreciate that.
I got to ask you, because it's just like every time it's one of these things that I can definitely go back and reread every time. I just capture more of it. Have you ever thought of, like, trying to put it in, like, a different, like, I don't know, when I read it, I could just see this, like, as a, you know, cable show for some reason. I just think it's a great way of telling a story, and I just think it's a great story. I mean,
thanks. It's I've had offers over the years, but it wasn't quite the right. It wasn't going to end up in the right hands or do the right thing. So I still have it, the rights to it, and I've always pictured it as some sort of. I always pictured it visually. You know, to me, I was sometimes I felt like I was writing a book, but sometimes I felt like I was writing a TV show. And so I just kind of really, when I look back at it now, I feel like I had a TV series for about 10 years that I was directing and writing and stuff like that. So I've kind of already had that experience. I feel like I did see it on TV because I can see it and I can hear the music and the voices and all that stuff. But you know, as more and more people discover the book, as it gets older, maybe, you know, who knows what the future will bring. It would be wonderful to see it on a screen someday if it was done well.
Right. You can't blame me for that. There's too many horror stories out there about people taking source material and then turning it into something that's not even close to it.
I know. My big fear was that I would take this, the work of my life and hand it over to somebody for cheap coin and be avoiding a bad movie the rest of my life. You know? Cause you know, whatever they paid me, it'd long be gone and we'd still have that stinko movie around. So I'm glad I didn't do any of those bad deals, but if somebody really wonderful came along and had the right idea, I would love to talk to them.
Cool.
And that number is BR5 4949.
Oh, God, I wonder how many people are actually going to get that joke.
Two.
Yeah.
Me and my mom.
Yeah, unfortunately, I get that too, so I feel old right now.
Yeah, you're old. You're too old.
And you also, from there, you went on to do Echo, which was kind of almost like a superhero story.
Yeah, it was. It was an empowered being, an empowered person. But I was really kind of doing my homage to 60s sci-fi, you know, like Twilight Zone and right. All those great shows, you know.
And currently you're working, if I'm not mistaken, it's Rachel Rising?
Yes, the horror series.
I mean, can you give just our listeners just a little bit more about that?
Well, it's an idea that I've had in the back of my mind for a long time about this girl who would not die. And that's not a new idea, of course. So it was all about the setup and the mood and the atmosphere and the town. And so in my mind, I was trying to develop it over the years in my mind as some sort of a noir comic, you know, comic noir.
Right.
Without having to write like Dashiell Hammett, I was trying to think more along the lines of Hitchcock or David Lynch. You know, if those two got together and made a movie, that would be a good movie. Damn, that would be a good, I wish those two had worked together. So anyway, I was thinking like that, you know, like Twin Peaks and Psycho and creepy things. You know, I'd had good success with SIP and touching emotional buttons with readers.
Right.
That was very satisfying, but I wondered about the challenge of, could I actually get a comic book reader to get creeped out? Which it seems like a silly idea because it's just lines on paper on, you know, a little bitty flippy book. And, it's, you know, who knows where they're reading it. They're reading it in a subway or in their house with the TV on. You know, they're not in the mood that you would hope if you, you know, if it's a movie with music and everything and you set the mood and then you scare them. It's easier to control somebody in a movie theater. But to get them in with the comic book and get them to read and get involved and then to actually get the hair on their arms to stand up, I, as a writer, I thought, gosh, if I could do that, I would do a backflip. So I just went for it. You know, I just thought, okay, well, I'll draw this book like it's a movie and I'll try to pace it and time it so that I can get those powerful moments. And that's what I've been trying to do is tell a horror story that would creep you out without a lot of gore.
Very hard to do that these days. Personally, I'm not a fan of the gore, so it's just I don't get the shock value of that from people. So
it's, I know, some of the gore is kind of just, you know, like gore porn. But sometimes it's funny, you know, like the movie Reanimator. I think that movie is hilarious because it's just way over the top. There's blood everywhere, so you just start getting giggly about it. It's just silly. Of course the man's covered in blood, and they're going to talk, you know. But the stuff where, you know, they have, you know, things like Saw and all that, I think that's just torture porn, so I didn't want to go into that. I really wanted to just kind of do the old-fashioned get your mind working and let you finish the scary stuff because that makes it even worse, you know.
Cool. Very cool. Now, you also have some you did a run for Runaways, and that was I mean, that I'm a big fan of that book in general, and you know, you did a great job with that.
Thank you.
You also did kind of a cutesy little thing, Spider-Man Loves Mary Jane.
Mm-hmm. I did that because everybody was telling me to do an all-ages something, because everything I was doing was mature. And I have a 13 or 14-year-old niece at the time, and I just thought, well, I'll write something she might want to read. So I just thought, you know, I was trying to write to the YA, the young adults. And it was actually, I got to tell you, it was a kick because I was working with the original cast, you know, Peter Parker and Gwen and Mary Jane in high school with Flash and Liz and everything. I mean, that's the cast I fell in love with. So it's before all the dark stuff came in. It was just, you know, this high school kid with a a uniform under his clothes, and he'd have to catch the H train down to Manhattan and then go back to Queens at night and have dinner, you know? So I thought it was – that's a great setup. I had a lot of fun writing that.
Cool.
I think it's the H train. I don't know if – I just guessed at that. I don't know which line goes from Queens to Manhattan.
Way too many.
Too many.
So I got to ask, I mean, it's – who would you say, like, some of your influences are?
You mean in comics?
No, just in general. You know, art, comics, writing.
Well, I grew up watching everything, all the TV shows and all the movies, and I love music. And I read about all the musicians over the different centuries. And the novelists. So I have a really broad range of interests, and I like creators over a 400-year span, you know, in all these categories. But I think that the ones that have stuck with me the most are probably the pin-up girl illustrators from the 20th century, you know, the old guys.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, like Gil Elfgren and all those guys. I love that beautiful stuff. And they put women on a pedestal and, you know, and just made them gorgeous and beautiful. And I just thought that was a really great thing. So I like those. And I like the 60s sci-fi guys, the ideas and the open-minded approach to living on terra firma. In music, I love the classical and the jazz and everything that ever happened in rock and roll and blues and all that. You know, it's just, gosh, I that's a long answer, you know. When it comes to just drawing with a pen and ink, though, I would have to, you know, trying to be relevant here. The guy I've admired the most over the years has been Alex Raymond, I think. His style was so beautiful. I have a couple originals of his daily Rip Kirby here in the house. And every day I look at him and I see something every day that inspires me on it, you know, a little economy of line or a really clever way to do a pattern or something. And he was one of the greats for me. So Rip Kirby and Charles Schulz in terms of making his own fantasy world and being able to live in it every day. That was a real touchstone for me, how to live in your imagination, you know, and make a living out of it. You know who does that today is the guy that writes Doctor Who.
Moffat?
Yeah, the main showrunner, producer guy that writes most of them. He's in his own world, and we're all enjoying it. And so guys like that I admire.
I can understand why. I can't say I'm a Who fan, but... kind of a Moffat fan from his like comedy Coupling.
Oh, I love that show.
Yeah, it's so to hear him on when I first heard he was doing Doctor Who, I was just like, okay, that's kind of weird to me. But
that's the thing is, you know, a guy will have something successful, or a guy or a woman, they'll write something successful and it's a blue wagon and everybody thinks, oh, okay, you do blue wagons. And then they go off and do a red wagon story and everybody's shocked. But it's all from the same, you know, thing. It's all the same world, you know.
Yeah, completely understand.
So I have a question for you, Terry. A couple months ago, you did... genders and comics for one of the colleges. It's a two-part question. How did you enjoy doing that, and would you be doing it again?
Oh, I would definitely do that again. And it was a blast because Christy Blanche put together a class, and she advertised it for a couple of months online through Twitter and everything. And the class enrollment ballooned up to 7,500 students, I think, around the world. What a tremendous success. So here was a professor who, instead of only being able to teach to whoever could find a seat in front of her in a room, was suddenly teaching 7,500 people around the world in one go. gosh, what a success that was. And she, fortunately, she was doing a topic that benefits the comic industry, which was genre and comics. And it brought a lot of people into the medium. I meet people all the time at conventions this year that say, I'm here because I enrolled in that class. And so now I'm reading comics and da-da-da. So it was a wonderful success on all levels, I think. And Christy, gosh, she was definitely a trailblazer there in terms of showing people how to do it. I hope she does one a year at least. And I hope other people will follow suit and do it as well. The people out there in the internet world sure jumped on it when they had the chance. So it's a great idea. It's a great way to expand your audience and talk about worthwhile things.
It's a good.
It was a blast to be a part of. Yeah.
It's a good way to learn too.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Terry, is there a character out there or an idea out there that you want to work on that you haven't yet or are looking to do in the future?
You mean in terms of a character that belongs to somebody else?
Anything. It could be something that you're in your head you want to do in the future or someone maybe in the property.
Yeah, I definitely have a couple of other things in my mind that I want to do. There's the next series that I would do as a comic book is drafted up and ready to go. Not because I'm so organized, but because for a long time I was talking with a friend at Vertigo about doing a series over there. And so we developed this idea and it developed, outlined it really well and pitched it and, It didn't work out business-wise to do it, so I have this wonderful story in my drawer and ready to go. That's what I would do next. And then I have a couple of other ideas that I'd like to do in the future if I live long enough. But in terms of other people's characters, the only one I ever really wanted to get my hands on was Supergirl. And for a while after SIP, for a few months, I campaigned DC to give me a shot at it. It didn't work out, but I always thought that she was not being handled right, that she's just a sidekick for all the male guys, and she should be one of the big four. Why Wonder Woman is a bigger icon than her shows you how badly she's been mishandled. So I always thought, she should be one of the big three at DC, But I think that ship has sailed now that they've all gone off to Icon Land and they're going to join the fate of, Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner and all that. Turn into store merchandising icons.
Lovely.
That Warner Brothers machine, they can do it, can't they?
Mm-hmm.
Now, on your schedule... You're scheduled to be in Baltimore next month. Have you ever been before?
Yeah, several times, yeah. It's a good show, a really good show. And it's grown a lot in the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Well, I live in that area, so I've been for the past 10 years.
There you go.
So I actually get to meet you first face-to-face.
This year?
Yeah, I'll see you on Saturday.
Good, okay. Well, I'm looking forward to the show. It's a great way. It's my last stop in the U.S. for the year, and it's a great way to finish off the con season.
Oh yeah,
I've been to Baltimore a couple times too. It's not as crazy as like some of the other cons I've been to. Like I usually hit up New York Comic Con. I can't say I've ever been to San Diego, but it's just I don't know. There's something about the attitude there. It's a lot better than some other cons, I feel. And it just—I feel like everybody's just much more approachable too.
Yeah, I think people are pretty relaxed there as far as creators. I don't know if that's because it's in the second half of the year and everybody is, more at ease with conventions. I don't know, or if it's just the neighborhood. But I tell you, every convention I've been to this year has been a big success. For the organizers, people are really coming out to the shows this year. So I would expect Baltimore should do very well.
Yeah, it usually does, and the good thing is and the bad part is they do the Indy race usually on Labor Day, and this year the actual con show is right after that, so it gets a little hectic. So you're going from one huge event to another huge event within the first 2 weeks of September, but it's you know I have to give them credits. It's well organized. I mean it's crowded, but it's not like overwhelming. And you actually get to sit and talk to the artists rather than you know getting scooted along just to get an autograph and then move on to the next.
Yeah, there are only a few people that still work a rank and file, you know, system with lines and all that. But most everybody I've seen in the last couple of years has relaxed a lot about just being engaging and open and accessible to the fans.
Oh, yeah. I got to sit with a couple guys last year, and I'm looking forward to meeting you and a couple other guys out there.
Thank you. I'll be there. Lord willing.
So besides Rachel Rising, are you working on anything else right now, Terry?
You know what? I just finished a lot of other outside projects that were kind of killing me a lot, but I've just about got them done, which was the SIP Omnibus. Was a tremendous amount of work, and then we had to get it off, sent off to China, and then we had to track its printing, and then we had to work it so that it comes back on time, and we just now got them in the warehouse, and we're filling our orders over the next week or two. So it's the end of a long road with that Strangers in Paradise Omnibus. So that's been what I've been using my extra time for. But I also had to make other books for the convention season, a new sketchbook. And we redid Strangers in Paradise number one as a color edition and got Steve Hammaker to color it. And I had that for San Diego. And I still have some of those left that we're selling. So those other books were what were keeping me really occupied all year. Just kind of coming to a point now where I'm wrapping all those up and they're all done. So when we get these omnibus orders out, I'll be caught up and I'll just be Rachel Rising on, you know, just the regular issues on schedule. So I'm looking forward to that. It's been a busy year.
Now, Terry, are you doing commissions for Baltimore?
No, I've had to stop because it was just so time consuming and, you know, I just wasn't able to do it and stay on deadline with all the other stuff. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. I like doing them because I like the ideas that some people come up with, you know, that I get to draw something I haven't drawn before. But it's a luxury that I can't afford right now. If I can draw, I need to be drawing something on deadline.
Cool.
And you also have you did the cover for the Overstreet Guide this year.
I did. I got to do a variant cover to benefit Hero Initiative, and my local store, Bedrock City Comics, they called me up and said, we have this opportunity and to do a cover with, I think 500 print run. And, they had an idea to do a take on an old Golden Age comic cover, you know, a classic thing with a lady on a table, kind of loosely chained up and a big headed monster coming after her. I did a take on that, a modernized take on that. And, it was a trip, you know, because the whole time I was drawing, I don't know if Matt Baker drew that cover, you know, back in the late 50s, early 50s, but he was really known for that stuff. And I was kind of trying to channel my inner Matt Baker for that. There's a guy that should get more street cred these days, don't you think? He did a lot of good work.
Yeah, he did.
Worked himself to death. He had a short career, but very talented man.
Cool. So, we really appreciate you coming on, talking with us today. Is there anything you'd like to plug while you're with us?
I'll plug comics. If somebody is happens to be listening to us because they're trying to find something else, we're talking about comics, and comics are still around, and they're a lot of fun. And I really think that some of America's best short story writers and illustrators are working in the field of comics right now, because where else are they going to go? So comics are something worth checking out, and I'm really glad for all the readers that we do have, but there's room for a lot more. So I'm glad you guys are spreading the word.
Well, thanks for coming on again, Terry. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again. All right. Have a good night.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
Terry Moore, ladies and gentlemen.
Hooray.
Oh.
Yeah, let's see that Rachel Rising. See how that works out for him. Hopefully, it's successful for him.
We can hope. All right.
Well, let's move on today. We got some. We're going to kind of bypass some of the news today and give you some banter. Some of y'all online have been talking about, hey guys, we miss when you talk. So we're going to talk a little bit today, and I'm going to bring up some stuff that we've been. Shameless plugs, if you want to say, or shameless ripoffs. So there's a couple of characters out there that we think are originals, and when they're duplicated, we go, well, that's the original. Well, no, maybe it is, maybe it's not. So we're gonna do a little game today. We're gonna see if you guys can pick who the original is. I know Brian probably knows all these by heart, so I'm gonna say Brian for last.
Yes, sir.
All right. But let's see. I'm going to read you a synopsis, okay? And we're going to see if Hopkins and Sanchez can guess.
Synopsis?
Synopsis, yes. All right, here we go. Mutated freaks gathered by their wheelchair-bound mentor in order to protect the world that fears and hates them. Are we talking about who, Mr. Sanchez?
Brian in 10 years.
Oh, come on! 3 seconds. Two.
I know any Professor X, but that's what I'm going with.
You're going with X-Men?
Yeah.
Survey says. Hopkins, who do you think we're talking about?
Who is Carrot Top?
I have no clue.
Well, you would think the X-Men, but we're not talking about the X-Men. Well, technically, we're not talking about the X-Men. We're talking about DC's Doom Patrol. Yes, Marvel fans, I said that right. The X-Men are a shameless ripoff of DC's Doom Patrol. The Doom Patrol debuted.
You.
The Doom Patrol debuted in comics before everybody's favorite, more marketable mutant team came about. All right. So the X-Men and the Doom Patrol shared a lot of similarities from their leader, Professor X, and the Chief. They all had accidents happen to them, that made them who they were. Some were mutated by birth. Some were accidental, like the Fantastic Four and experiments.
Yourself.
Oh, be quiet. Even their tagline, was the same. On the top of the comic book, DC Comics had the world's strangest heroes, the Doom Patrol. And on the X-Men books from Marvel, it said the strangest superheroes of all, the X-Men. And that's not the only thing they shared in common. They also had their villain squad. All right. Who wants to take a stab at that name?
Yeah, I'm keeping quiet.
The Doom Patrol had the Brotherhood of Evil. And, of course, the X-Men had the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. So both were called the Brotherhood. And so let's talk about that now. People would assume that the X-Men came first, right? It's sort of like the... what came first, chicken or the egg argument. But you know, the Doom Patrol was swept under the rug, per se, because they are not as marketable. And that goes into discussion. What makes the X-Men more marketable than the Doom Patrol, even though they are basically sort of the same team? Mike Sanchez, you want to talk about that? Come on, Marvel boy.
I'm trying to gather my thoughts. I just stubbed the ever-living crap out of my toe.
As you have having beast feet.
Don't lie, you're Googling it right now.
I got you. So I got something for you to Google, Hopkins. Oh, my God. Just get back to me in a second here.
All right, Hopkins, why do you think the X-Men were more marketable than Doom Patrol?
Because they were teenagers, and at the time that they were introduced, was very popular amongst teenagers. So kids could find themselves relating to somebody who's more their age than somebody who's a little older.
Brian, do you agree?
Yeah, but I also think it also helps that they had, like, the biggest pitchman in the world. Doesn't help when it doesn't hurt, you know, having somebody like Stan Lee. The guy's, come on, we can all admit the guy's pretty much like a carnival barker.
That's right, True Believers.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I mean, that was my thing too, is that Stan Lee helped market the X-Men to be where they were today. And you know what Hopkins said too has a big part to do with it as well, is that, you know, the X-Men were made to be teenagers, where the Doom Patrol, they seem to be more grown at the time, and it just shows you the sign of the times too. Sanchez, go ahead with your thoughts before I move on.
Well, now that with my regenerative powers, my toe stopped bleeding because I'm awesome. I just believe that, you know, that more along the lines with what Brian said about Stan Lee. I mean, he's always, you know, during those times, you know, was very vocal and very instrumental with a lot of the characters that they were going ahead and coming up with. I think seeing kids, you know, seeing, you know, them as kids in that age, you know, people can go ahead and relate a lot more, since the general basis of all the fans were around that, you know, teenager age, you know, to the late teens. So it was easier for them to go ahead and see themselves in these characters, which, you know, a lot of people, you know, besides, you know, saying Superman and Spider-Man, you'll hear a lot of people say their favorite characters are X-Men based characters because of the relationship they had with these characters growing up.
Well, I also think X-Men was kind of more of a sign of the times too. I mean, X-Men was having to deal with, you know, being different, and, you know, you had the race thing going on at the same time. And while the Doom Patrol were people who were by accident, the mutants were by birth, and kind of, you know, you had that entire civil rights thing going on at the same time this comic's coming out. So it did speak to a lot of people because of that.
All right. Well, I mean, I agree on both sides there. So for all you Marvel guys, yes, the X-Men were ripoffs to a DC character yet again. We won't go there.
But as usual, Marvel does it better than DC. Next topic. Let's
move on here. All right. So let's talk about Superman. You would think that Superman was called, what, the first superhero. He's been called that a lot in print, that when Schuster and Siegel created him, he was the first ever, you know, super, super duper hero. Well, let's talk about this character by Philip Weil called Gladiator, all right? This novel came out in 1930, starring Hugo Danner, a man whose father invents a secret formula that could create superpowers. So instead of making millions, he injects his son with the serum, thus giving him superpowers, super strength, bulletproof skin, the ability to jump over tall buildings in a single bound, and basically all he was missing was the heat vision, and you have Superman. So when we think about this stuff, you know, original ideas, we complain about all the time about movies now, is that there's nothing original in Hollywood anymore, nothing original in comics. It's so hard to write now, because if you write something, you tend to start dipping into the well of somebody else. So here we have now this 1930s writer, you know, with this character called Gladiator, and all of a sudden, what in the help me out, Brian? In the what 50s was Superman?
Yeah, no 40s.
So 40s. Yeah, late somewhere in the 40s, you get this character.
1938.
All right, so you get 1930, you get Superman, and so it makes you wonder, you know, did Schuster and Siegel, in fact, you know, read this novel and go, well, hey, let's throw some tights on him and a cape, and bam, we have Superman.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you know, you argue all the time about this, about who has the better idea. But then it comes down to it, who marketed it better? I guarantee up until we just brought this up, nobody knew about this 1930s novel called Gladiator. Maybe Brian did. But
well, the interesting thing is DC did revisit it after the Crisis of the Infinite Earths. When everything was wrapped, when they got rid of Earth 2, they combined it with Earth, you know, so everything was just one Earth, so now you have the Justice Society predating the Justice League. But they still had to fill those gaps for the Superman-type character, the Batman and everything. So what they did is they went back to the original source of Hugo Danner and created his son, Iron Monroe, back in 87. And his powers were actually very similar to what his father's were.
Right.
So they're actually referencing, yeah, Roy Thomas, who the man is a historian to begin with as a writer. He, you know, he pretty much, referenced Gladiator there. And kind of made everything almost a little full circle, you could say.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, it always does. There is some sort of homage paid at some way, shape, or form, but you know, when I found this article online, I thought it was so interesting because, you know, there's always an argument of basically who came first or what idea was original. And, you know, the more you read into this, you go, wow, I mean, maybe we're wrong. And, you know, this next one will surprise a lot of people. I know there's two people on this podcast this will surprise, that G.I. Joe, for example. Action figures have existed since the 1960s, but it wasn't until 1982 that G.I. Joe gained their personalities. All right? So the G.I. Joes we know and love, their enemy, of course, is what? Mike?
Cobra!
All right. So, in fact, Cobra is a direct ripoff of...
The Brady Bunch!
Hydra! Cut off one head and two more will grow, or whatever that goes. And
now you got
Tommy Lee Jones's iconic speech: "Let's go find two more." Hydra, it was actually came first, and the whole Cobra thing was a ripoff of that. And then DC had their version of Cobra with K's, and you know, again, you gotta laugh and say, you know, thing with Captain America, you know, bringing Hydra to the light, and you know, I'm not saying it was never in the darkness, because you know, Marvel has been pretty good with the whole Hydra and Captain America and all that running stuff. But you know, everyone loves G.I. Joe. I mean, even if you watch the old cartoons on Boomerang and whatnot, you kind of laugh at the laser beams going pew 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 pew, pew and all that stuff. But
how did they go again?
But I just so y'all know, we didn't script that Cobra thing. I knew one of them was going to do it, and the fact that both did it was even greater. But yeah, I mean, what do you think about that? Let's start with Sanchez about G.I. Joe's Cobra rant being a ripoff of Hydra.
Well, I mean, for once, I have to say that, you know, that G.I. Joe did it better than Marvel. I mean, I am a huge G.I. Joe fan and have been forever in love with Cobra, no homo. But, you know, to me, I just felt that he always had a better array of characters because compared to the Hydra. I mean, Hydra had their basic core, but you can probably list for days all the characters that Cobra had that, you know, you found a niche in each one of them that it was just so much fun to you know, watch the cartoon and also read the books when they came out, you know, funny to say with Marvel, but I've always had, you know, a fun time with them, reading them, reading all the characters, reading all the missions and ridiculous inaccuracy shooting of each of these teams.
All right. Well, Hopkins, real quick, you, because I have one more before we have to switch over. So what do you think?
Oh.
All right. All right, well, let's go to my last one, and this one is going to be just out of pure humility, because you know what? I will, in fact, admit when I'm wrong every now and then. Let's talk about my name the grace here, the Cape Crusader, the Dark Knight himself, Batman. We all know. In fact, I'm going to let Brian spoil this one for everyone. Brian, Batman is a direct ripoff of whom?
Zorro.
Tis correct. When Bob Kane has gone on record saying Batman is a mixture of Zorro, Leonardo da Vinci's machines and gadgets was a big influence as well. And we all have seen that little meme where it's Zorro, Sherlock Holmes, and, you know, a man equals Batman. But yes, Batman too can be called to have a sort of ripoff to the original Masked Man, which is Zorro. And one thing I found good was that they've always paid homage to Zorro, and Brian can agree that in every origin story, with the exception of the latest one, Batman Begins, they've always painted a picture of him going to see the Mask of Zorro with his parents at the movie theater that night. And I can say that, you know, that's, you know, one of the rare occasions where you see they have a lot of similarities. You know, Zorro as a man was a rich man, you know, and he put on the costume and he thwarted evil. So, Brian, you want to talk about that real quick?
I mean, that's pretty much was this, that Zorro was definitely the inspiration behind Batman. You know, you have the rich playboy helping out the common people. Of course, Zorro wasn't as dark as Batman was. But then again, it was a different time. You know, when Zorro came out, it was a lighter time. When Batman came out, they were just coming right off the pulp novels where, you know, heroes would kill. That was a common factor. But, you know, it's like Jay said, it's just like pretty much every origin is a retelling of him, has always acknowledged and never really forgot that, you know, his origins did come from Zorro, which was always cool.
Man, I know in the animated series they use the Gray Ghost. I'm sure they was due to the fact that they couldn't get the rights to put Zorro in the cartoon like that without having to pay a ton of money. That I understood, you know, at that point. But this list had so many others on there too that are relevant, like, you know, the Green Lantern is one of them.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you look at a lot of these characters and you can break them down to where the inspiration came on. I mean, you could call it a ripoff, or, you know, you could actually just look at the inspiration. I mean, you know, one of the more famous ones, obviously, is the Captain Marvel Shazam to Superman. And, you know, you had that famous lawsuit case that didn't happen, that, you know, got thrown out of court. But, you know, it's just, there are a ton of characters out there. I mean, some people say Spider-Man's a knockoff of the, you know, pulp character, the Spider.
Absolutely, absolutely false. Move on.
Captain America is a knockoff of the Shield, who was the actual first patriotic hero.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Next topic.
But, you know, it's, you know, call them homages, call them knockoffs, call them ripoffs. And it's, you know, this day and age, I don't know. I feel it's just like there is no more original material. Everything is just a variation on a theme.
And that's what I said when I started the monologue. It's very tough now to find something that will work without someone going, oh, yeah, just like so-and-so. Oh, yeah, just like that. And, you know, it's tough. And that's why, you know, people say, you know, why are we rebooting this? Why are we telling the same story again? Because you almost have to nowadays.
True. And, you know, moving in regards to speaking of all the time, and right now, we've been leaning more and more to regards to Mega Collector. We're going to go ahead and discuss a little bit about that meter and what's going on with it. As we all know, the subscription ends, or I should say, will probably be postponed on August 19th. A lot of DC collectors and even Ghostbusters collectors are not too happy with Toy Guru and his surprising amounts of YouTube videos in regards to the Ecto-1 and the DC Infinite Earths line. Just as of today, I've checked and I saw here that DC the Masters of the Universe line went from a miraculous 36% to 48% in one day, but it seems as though the DC Universe is gone from the cankles to the calves, which is up to 26%. Maddie's gone ahead and made many videos, urging and pretty much begging for everyone to go ahead and subscribe now. Don't wait till the last minute. They've gone ahead even as much as the Four Horsemen has gone ahead and posted a post asking the fans to go ahead and help out and sign up for the subscriptions and, make sure, try and, get maybe, an additional one. It just seems that compared to the last 2 years, they seem to be going ahead and seeming more desperate in the attempts to get more subscribers to go ahead and join the ranks of the subscription. I just signed up the other day for my Infinite Earth, my first one, which it looks like to be maybe the last one. What do you guys have? I'm sure you guys have been seeing on Facebook, on Maddie Collector, all these videos and posts. What are you guys' thoughts right now at the status of these lines?
I don't think Neelix's posts are as bad as some of these friggin' fans that are out there. I'm on this one page, and this one guy who goes by the fake name of Connell every day is posting, "You gotta buy the subscription, you gotta buy the subscription." Oh, shut up! What, do you get a percentage of this, you whiny little bitch?
Well, I mean, some people want these things to happen, and I'm one of them. And he's lobbying for something he wants. And there's so many haters out there who are anti-subscription. And they don't understand, that Mattel can't show the list. They can't tell you what's up. The request of what people want to subscribe can't happen. And that's the thing is, yes, people want to be more – I've always lobbied this too. People would be more comfortable with it if they knew what they were buying. I mean, you don't pre-buy the 2014 car model if it's going to have 5 miles to the gallon when it comes out. People want to feel comfortable with their purchase. And what Mattel has shown at San Diego has not put enough confidence in people's hearts to go and pull the trigger right now. The only thing is they said, hey, if we reach this impossible tier two, that – we will give you this unleashed doomsday that everyone's been talking about. And that's the thing is they're saying, hey, you've been asking for this figure, so sub. And people are saying, so I'm going to sub. I'm going to commit to $275 for an unleashed version of doomsday that I may not get.
I agree with you, Jay, but just in one aspect, I mean, I don't know. I haven't really paid attention to the last 2 years. Would you say that this year's first three figures are stronger than the previous 2 years?
No, they're. I mean, honestly, I have to say they're actually, with the exception of Ice, I wasn't too impressed. I can really give a crap about Grant Morrison's Aquaman. Will I have him? I'll put him in my collection. I'll find a spot for him somewhere.
Wait, Grant Morrison's Aquaman?
Isn't that Grant Morrison's Aquaman? 90s Aquaman? Morrison's JLA run?
No, that's. Oh, God.
Oh, God, you're going to make me cry. It's Peter David's.
Either way, it's a 90s Aquaman with a hook hand.
It was Peter David who made him the badass. Okay, let's get it straight.
Let me continue here for a second. Before we go back to that little minor mishap, I'll find a spot on my shelf for the hook hand Aquaman. The Superboy from the Young Justice that we all want, it's not Young Justice Superboy, it's just the Superboy with the, jeans and the shirt everybody wanted.
Which we couldn't get the first time around for legal reasons.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is what they had said was, if you listen to that one interview, that was supposed to be a 50-50 variant from the, I believe it's Wave 6 Superboy, the return of Superman, Superboy, the 90s with the biker jacket and the glasses. It was supposed to be a 50-50 variant. And because, like Brian said, because of the legal reasons, they couldn't put it in that way. And, I mean, I know the word tooling has been thrown away on so much of this subscription that if I hear someone say the word – if I hear the word tooling one more time, I'm going to kick a puppy.
The only tool there is
– Oh, kick a puppy! Kick a puppy!
Is Toy Guru, because while I can understand them why they can't release what's coming down the pike – the fact they don't tell us what the damn – what the need is, what we need to reach. This is opposed to the fact that they can't tell us what the line entails for the DC line. That is one of the banes of the subscription. The other thing is people don't like the threat-o-meter when they ain't saying what the goal is.
Yeah,
Scott keeps saying that they can't say it, but that's bull. You know, I'm sorry. This is stuff that is – that's why they have stockholders releases all the damn time. They can release this information. They choose not to and rather have the stupid threat-o-meter.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I have coined the phrase – bullshit-o-meter. I am now going to coin another phrase. It's Mattygate. The Toy Guru is the president of the United States from Mattygate. He's not a crook, but yet they can't tell us nothing.
I mean, I've gone so far as saying they should do it in the way of, in a sense, though, the same type of layout as a Kickstarter. I mean, at least, you know, show something more. This is not, you know, people, they say they fix everything and everything and everything. They're fixing all this stuff, but they're not fixing one of the crucial aspects is just to give us a number. Show us what you need. I mean, that meter is nothing. It could mean 50 for all we know to 5,000. We just don't know how many you need.
No, I'm sorry.
In the past years, we've seen this thing up until the day before the deadline be well below.
Jump.
And then he swears on his self that it does is not fixed, not fixed. These are actual numbers. And you know what? They may not be. We don't sit in that board. We don't know. But what we do know is if you want 6-inch adult collector classic Four Horsemen sculpted DC superheroes, you need to buy this sub. I mean, you can't be lazy anymore, guys. People have been lucky enough to get people who want to sell these things on eBay on the secondary market and hike the price up a little bit to make a couple bucks here and there.
But maybe it's time to end the line. Maybe it is time to end the line. There's been too many bad choices with this line.
Out of the 2 years, there are three figures not on my shelf that I traded off. Those figures are Larfleece, Atrocitus.
And
only two. I'm sorry. I have them all, but only two. Just Atrocitus and Larfleece because I prefer the DC Direct versions based on their sculpt.
See,
that's just a personal thing for me.
But
and
when
I have
them
all on my desk.
But when they originally said the first time around, they said they were going to do this. It was going to be for the fans, delving deep in the histories of DC Comics. When the fuck did Larfleece become history? He's a new character. Let's go deep in here, guys. I call bullshit on that one.
Well, I mean, he has gone ahead, and I think it was with Action Figure. I forgot the website, honestly. Action Figure Community or whatever. He had an interview with him recently. You know, one of the
AFI
guys,
Action Figure.
Yes.
Center, yeah.
Yes, guys. Sir. And I heard the entire interview. And he's,
the butt kissers.
Yes. And the guru said, you know, we're going to go ahead and have a couple civilian releases, something that we've all been waiting for. But it just bothers me that they're waiting. He's waiting this long with this little time left to let us know this. You know, he's talking about maybe a Commissioner Gordon, which, honest to God, it wouldn't be that difficult to make because they already have a body for it. They can use the Question. They can use Constantine. I mean, they can use any of those bodies for that. It's not that difficult.
That's my recipe.
You shut up. Shut your face.
But and do also, you actually think they're going to go through with that? Seriously? Do you think
he made an announcement, he rattled off a bunch of names. And the names he rattled off, I mean, if you count them, that's sort of a list. I mean, if you count what's not been announced, what has been announced, and the names he rattled off, I mean, he can't be quoted that those are the actual things they're gonna make. But I mean,
where's Damian Wayne?
If that's the list, then there you go.
Don't need him.
Well, he's gonna come out from because he also said that they do already have Damian Wayne. So when he's released, because he said when.
But then why are people saying it's canceled?
It was canceled on the retail line. It was canceled on the retail line.
Damian was originally going to be in the Batman Unlimited retail line because the retail line was canceled. They had to shelf him somewhere.
Yeah, the retail line was canceled because these dopes decided somewhere along the line that, hey, let's make a line of cheap-ass action figures based on a crappy action video game instead of giving people what they want. Injustice was a bad idea. It was, you got your video game people who love it out there, fine. But you know what? You don't deserve figures for it.
No, I agree. The figures were horribly made.
That's what killed the line. Because then these people, you know, the stores didn't want to buy it because they weren't selling. Because they looked like ass.
They should have been GameStop exclusives and been done with it. Only available there. I mean, it's a tough one, guys. I mean, do I think it's going to happen? I think we may hit tier one. But the thing is, they also announced that the ones that have been already made will be released as quarterly figures down the road or even convention exclusives.
Big Lots.
Now, this is what I think should happen. There's a good – I mean, there's 26 to 27% of America – that's subbed up already. I believe the right thing should be, we should be, if you subbed up, you should be allowed first crack at these and not have to pay the inflated price that they're going to offer these. Because you know these are going to be at $30+ if they go quarterly like this. Because that's because they're going to try to say, hey, we're not punishing you guys. Oh, yes, you are. But, you know, it's...
Technically, they're not because, you know, lower volumes unfortunately means increased prices.
I mean, someone else made a good notion. How to put both Doomsdays in the sub. Build a figure. Put a piece of the Unleashed Doomsday in the last six figures. That's basically what these things are build a figures. They use the same Kilowog and our Kilo's Buck. I mean, all they gotta do is put pieces in there and there you go. I mean if someone said you would get both Doomsdays, I guarantee we'd hit the at least mid above tier one, almost mid to tier two. If they said you're getting both Doomsdays,
why?
Then you would save on packaging.
I just don't get the appeal of Doomsday. He's a one character. He's a one trick pony, people.
But his one trick pony is going to sell it.
God, get a real find a real person to be in love with.
I mean, I want Mento. I want my Mento to finish my Doom Patrol. I mean, that's honestly what I want.
I want my Chief. That's who I want. That's what's going to take.
I have my custom of the Chief.
I want my Damian Wayne.
Screw him.
Oh yeah, well I want him too then.
I mean, it's just guys. It's one of those things where you know the subscription was made so that you know we can still get our figures, and I mean it's. You don't have to waste gas. Yeah, you're paying a buttload of shipping to get this figure to you, but I mean, it's.
But
it is
thing,
what it,
okay.
end of the day, it is what it is.
Let me just explain something about the shipping and stuff. What people fail to seem to understand, it's not shipping. It's shipping and handling. What that means is that is cost to get it from China all the way to the warehouse. To get sorted, someone has to physically pick and pack it to put it into a warehouse rack, then pick and pack it when somebody wants to order it. That's labor. That's packaging. You have to put it in a cardboard box. That costs money. This is shipping and handling. Handling. This is not a small mom-and-pop operation where they don't need to pay handling. That's the problem. People don't understand what this thing shipping and handling means.
But they're telling us they're running under the budget. Like they're not making enough money to cover all this stuff.
They gotta pay workers to package this stuff. I've been on a front line of a pick and pack warehouse. It's not easy.
Well, let's also not ignore the fact that because of the low numbers, they've actually stopped, or so they say, stopped all aspects of this operation. So they're even saying is April or May figure may get skipped because of the time stoppage. And then we'll have to have a double figure in a month coming where you get two figures instead. I mean, it's one of those things, guys, where it's not going to be pretty, guys. I mean, this might be the last we see of DC 6-inch figures.
It's had a good run. Maybe it's just time to pack it up. But, I mean, that pretty much takes us to the end of our show, guys. So, you know, make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, as always. And for Sanchez, Jay, and Mike, this has been the Fanboy Factor. Night, all.